Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 8th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program, folks, it is Casual Friday. And Heather Parton, or Digby, will be joining us. And then later, ostensibly to recommend to us a streaming movie for the weekend, Isabel Gillies will be here from isabelgillies.com. Also on the program today, Donald Trump wages his own personal war versus Canada, leaves the G7 summit early. But worry not, Trump is totally prepared for the North Korea summit. Meanwhile, the Trump administration joins a suit that may destroy the ACA's patient protections. And 1,600 immigration detainees head to federal prison as a former DACA deportee killed in Mexico. 19-year-old boy. Paul Ryan claims that he'll produce immigration legislation. And a New York Times reporter has her record seized unknowingly by the Justice Department. Meanwhile, Paul Manafort, feeling very lonely, as all his friends have become hostile witnesses. And the Democratic leaders of the Congress have perfected their ability to pre-capitulate. Lastly, I should also say Trump's tariffs will shelve billions of dollars worth of solar projects. Mission accomplished. And lastly, rest in peace, Anthony Bourdain, who reportedly has taken his own life. Sad day. All that and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. It is a Friday. As you know, on Fridays, we try and keep it casual around here. Everybody's dressed down a little bit.
I'm wearing leggings as pants, y'all.
I was going to say.
Just so you know.
Everybody looks basically the same. although you look like you've actually dressed up a little bit, Michael. You have a hard-collared shirt on.
I wear shirts like this.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But to wear it on Friday, it just stands out. I, of course, am wearing a soft-collared shirt. A lot of people reacted very positively to me wearing a V-neck T-shirt last week, but I'm sorry. I can't break the habit of the soft-collared T-shirt. Couldn't do it two weeks in a row.
You don't want to saturate the market.
Yeah, I don't want to go overboard with that. I do want to remind you that this program exists because of its members. If you listen to this program on even a semi-regular basis and you enjoy it and you want to support it, please do. You can do so by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you join themajorityreport.com, we give you an extra hour or so of content every day. That's a little bit of a laugh riot sometimes. Sometimes not a laugh riot. But
sometimes
also,
it's an attempted laugh riot.
Sometimes an attempted fail.
Does not succeed.
Other times we get some fascinating phone calls from listeners. And sometimes
some
we get some
boring phone
not
calls. Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. So in other words, it's hit or miss. But with that said, it is a way of supporting the free part of this program. If you do not have the resources to become a member, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will hook you up. So next week, Donald Trump will be headed to, really, I guess in just days, will be headed to Singapore for a summit with the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. And look, there may be a lot of issues involved in this, right?
Maybe.
What might benefit Kim Jong-un? What might benefit South Korea? What might benefit Japan? What might benefit China, Russia, the United States? What might benefit? I mean, there's so many different factors involved in something like this. So one would think maybe you should prepare a lot. But if you did, you probably haven't been elected president lately.
I think I'm very well prepared. I don't think I have to prepare very much. It's about attitude. It's about willingness to get things done. But I think I've been preparing for the summit for a long time, as has the other side. I think they've been preparing for a long time also. So this isn't a question of preparation. It's a question of whether or not people want it to happen. And we'll know that very quickly.
So the bottom line is he's not prepared. He has not done any preparation, but he is already prepared, of course. And, you know, in some respects, he may be right. I mean, if I was any member of the team that was responsible for setting up this summit and for doing it, look, most of the negotiations are done already, right? I mean, they have already negotiated a lot of this. We spoke to Tim Shurik, and I think like there was a sense that, you know, everything was more or less done except for the T's and the I's. It's perfectly reasonable to assume that Donald Trump said to his people, like, you handle all that stuff. I will do the signing. And that's probably the safest thing for everybody involved. It's probably the smartest thing, knowing his limitations. But his inability and complete disinterest in it is pretty shocking that he is the president of the United States.
Yeah, well, get used to it.
And, well, I think that even he realized, like, oh, maybe I should just make a little bit more of an effort to pretend like I prepared.
We are going to do very well. Now, if we're unable to make a deal, we'll terminate NAFTA. We'll have a better deal. If we are unable to make a deal, we will be better off. Right now,
pause it. I should say he's leaving the G7. And he's really mad at Canada because
they burned the White House.
Because they burned the White House, apparently. And
this is what happens when you discover new facts.
And
right?
don't read too carefully. And so Trump is under the impression that they burned the White House. I believe it was the British. Am I not mistaken?
1812, yep.
And I think he's also pissed probably because Ivanka expressed, you know, something positive about Trudeau.
Don't bring it up.
But,
shut up.
But here he is. He's mad at Canada. He's mad at Canada. And he's leaving the G7 early. And he's also now going to pivot to, oh, just remind you, not only am I going to be great with NAFTA, don't need to prepare for that one either, but also I don't need to prepare for the whole North Korea thing.
Not going to live with the deals the way they are. European Union treats us very unfairly. Canada, very unfairly. Mexico, very unfairly. With that being said, I think we'll probably very easily make a deal. Go ahead.
Were you serious about really not needing to prepare for the Kim summit?
No, I didn't say that. I said I've been preparing all my life. I always believe in preparation, but I've been preparing all my life. You know, these one-week preparations, they don't work. Just ask Hillary what happened to her in the debates. So I've been preparing for this all my life. And frankly, it's really just the fake news, because if you run, Peter, just a little bit longer, the clip, you would see I've really been preparing all my life. I said that, but of course, you know, the news doesn't pick that up because it's fake news.
Fake news.
Are we to believe that he has been studying North Korea and the issues around surrounding the potential reunification of Korea his whole life? Is that what he's suggesting? Or is he simply saying, all of my experiences have led up to being able to negotiate with a North Korean.
When I had homeless people defecate in hallways to force people out of their rent control departments so I could redevelop with money from my dad. When I cut a deal with the Lucchese family so that they and my dad could illegally subsidize my casinos. When I first asked my daughter out on a date when she turned 18. All of these moments have prepared me for negotiating with the most difficult country in the world. It's true.
I mean, that's what he's saying. Like,
if you like Hillary, you read briefing books. You go, ooh, I want to know about
the
economy of the Korean Peninsula. But if you're like me, when you met with the Bonanno family.
Thing where you get facts in your head about learning about something.
Ooh, grain supply chains.
Oh, wow.
I don't need to know that. I just need to know good, bad. That's all I need to do. I just look over to one of my people, good, bad. They say good, bad, and then I say I want the good, not the bad.
Say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go with the good.
As far away as he can be from the actual negotiations, I think the better. But I think it's quite possible that this is going to be a success in some ways. I hope so.
Mike keeps telling me to not do my Korean impression, but he'll love it.
Oh, yeah. Where did
we are about to make deal? Right? It's actually funny if he does something like that. Literally everybody else on the stage will be like, yeah.
Right, exactly. Of course. Here we go. Just whatever.
Okay, yep. Oh, nailed it. Exactly how my mom and dad sound. Okay,
price for peace.
Sign the paper and please get on the plane.
Folks, you've heard the phrase no honor among thieves. But what about the phrase no respect amongst clowns? In this clip, we have Seb Gorka talking about what a joke it is for Dennis Rodman to attend the summit as Seb Gorka prepares to travel to the summit. Yeah,
I called it, did I not?
What's that? That Gorka was going to be pissed?
Rodman was going to go over there.
It's very possible.
Wow.
Here we go.
Now, I've got to talk to you about Dennis Rodman. I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to talk to you about it.
Oh, okay? Please.
Rodman reportedly will be in Singapore for President Trump's summit with Kim Jong-un. What the devil is he doing there?
He's just a glory hound. He's a publicity seeker. Who cares? I mean, really.
This is a man who... Well, it makes it a circus, doesn't it? It's a distracting circus.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be getting a lot of photo opportunities at the summit table. This is a man who celebrated that regime as a guest of the regime repeatedly, a regime that, whilst we need to denuclearize the peninsula, remains a dictatorship. So Dennis Rodman is nothing more than a clown who's looking for more publicity.
It's like,
I don't know how to...
Looking for more publicity.
Beyond the obvious chutzpah, it's like...
I feel like
could count as much as anybody for laying the groundwork for this deal.
I think we could replay Seb Gorka's statement about Dennis Rodman and just record the words Seb Gorka as he says Dennis Rodman, and everything would make absolute sense.
I think Rodman's more qualified.
Yeah, did we not decide already that Rodman might be the best person to do this negotiation?
He certainly had, I think, more legitimate contact with any foreign leaders than Seb Gorka has, right? I mean, you are. Oh, God, Stuart, please.
Really? The black guy? Seriously?
Diplomatic.
Oh, sorry. Once again, Rebel TV talking points. You're supposed to do more subtext on Fox. Can we start that again, Sir Stuart? Glory Hound.
Glory Hound. Uppity.
Rebel.
So
monkey.
Uppity.
Uppity is great because that could work for both networks.
Wow. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Heather Partin, or as you may know her from her Uber blog, Hullabaloo. You maybe know her as Heather Partin from Salon, but from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. Hello, Digby. How are you?
Hey, Sam. I'm fine. How are you doing today?
Still sort of getting, trying to absorb Sepp Gorka complaining about a clown. Some type of clown who's going over there.
Sepp Gorka. Yes, he's very, very, very upset.
Apparently he is. I think he's actually afraid that he's that Rodman will in fact get more airtime than he will. I think it's a possibility.
And I think that's probably true, don't you? I mean, I think he will get more airtime.
I think it's very likely, actually, that we may see Rodman at that table, frankly. But
easy.
All right. Well, before we get to Singapore, let's talk about the G7. I think the days of everybody pretending they liked Donald Trump at these meetings as a way of trying to ingratiate themselves with him seem to be sort of waning. I think everybody's like losing their patience with him on some level. And he decided to leave early. There was some suggestion that he may not even go. At one point, that they would send Mike Pence, but he left, or he's, I guess he's going to leave early tomorrow morning in from Quebec and head to Singapore. But it seems to me we are now really, it's becoming a lot clearer the implications that. Having had Donald Trump as our president, hopefully for only 4 years, are going to resonate through the ages in terms of our position within the world.
Well, I don't know if you've seen the Economist magazine's cover story this week, but it's Trump riding on the wrecking ball like Miley Cyrus, called Trump's foreign policy, which is basically. He's just taking the board and just upending it, throwing the pieces all over the place. And I guess there are a lot of people who think that's a great idea. You know, maybe if it weren't for nuclear war and the lives of, billions of people in the balance, maybe that would be a fun thing to do. But, Trump is the president of the world's only superpower, tremendous military might and economic power in the world. So he's doing this. And I think we kind of knew he was going to, right?
Right.
I mean, he made
yes.
it very, very clear that he knows absolutely nothing about anything, and he's proud of it. And his only motives were these weird, kind of emotional, sort of ego-driven motives. The world is laughing at us. They've been laughing at us for years. We're going to make America great again. They're going to respect us. That's what's making him do whatever it is he's doing. And his own desire to be seen as a hero, which is really, and at this point he's kind of, in a weird way, he's actually narrowed that to the point where now he only cares about being a hero to his voters. He doesn't even care
right.
if anybody else sees him as a voter, as a hero. So, the motives for doing this are very primitive and, actually kind of puerile. They're childlike. That's how, 4-year-olds think before they, develop a stronger sense of self. So that's where we're at. And we're going to spend the next week watching him act this out on the world stage.
I am starting to think that there's actually sort of something bigger going on here. When we had, let me preface this by saying this is, I'm now entering into sort of like pure speculation, and I'm not positing anything terribly sophisticated here, but when Trump first assembled his cabinet, we had a guy named Dan Dicker on, who is a energy trader, or oil trader, or maybe advises on it now. And he said, you know, this administration looks to me like they're building, you know, something that is really centered around a petro state. And I look at like a guy like Scott Pruitt, who apparently cannot be fired. Right. I mean, it does not seem to be anything that can get him fired. And it seems like there are people in the White House trying to get him fired. Right. Like the leaking the stuff about him going to the commissary too much at the White House. I mean, all of that stuff. But his biggest benefactor, Scott Pruitt, is Harold Hamm. Harold Hamm has known Trump. And I just read up on this because I was, doing a hit on MSNBC about this last night. Harold Hamm apparently has known Trump since 2012. He is he's worth about $19 billion, much of it from fracking, mostly all from fracking. And, you know, when you start to see things like his tariffs causing solar projects, billions of dollars worth of solar projects to be shelved, when you start seeing this sort of like this relationship with Russia, you know, here's Donald Trump calling for Russia to be readmitted into the G7 or would be G8. I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea, but I just know that Donald Trump doesn't think deeply about anything, you know, from a sort of like a geopolitical sense. And so for some reason, he's saying this, and it's almost just like seems, I don't know, just too pat that Putin would be telling him to do it as much as, you know, other people around him telling him to do it for, like, you know, just somehow money getting in his pocket.
With that being said,
well, I mean,
listen to this clip.
Easily make a deal. Russia should be in this meeting. Why are we having a meeting without Russia being in the meeting? And I would recommend, and it's up to them, but Russia should be in the meeting. It should be a part of it. You know, whether you like it or not, and it may not be politically correct, but we have a world to run. And in the G7, which used to be the G8, they threw Russia out. They should let Russia come back in.
Donald Trump did not know this unless somebody told him this, right? I mean, this isn't coming from like, I mean, I just, you know, the answer for almost every question that you ask about the Trump administration is it means money going into his pocket in some fashion. And there's no reason to believe that this is not part of it. And you've got guys around him, guys like Harold Hamm, who surely must have some, I'm just convinced that he has this ongoing influence with the administration. If you see, you know, Pruitt still there. That's what it indicates to me that this is not a coincidence that the one guy who can't get fired is the guy who's responsible for regulations on energy in some fashion, or the burning of coal.
Right. I mean, I don't disagree with you at all. I think, look, I mean, isn't that how these oligarchical, oil, petro, countries right. work? I mean, you have this group of highly influential oligarchs that are sort of all around, trying to create a system that works to their advantage. And in this case, they see a mark, right? I mean, they see Trump coming. I feel like that's how everybody views him. They are figuring out, and many of them have already figured out, how to manipulate this simpleton to, do what they need him to do in his position in order to advance their own, their own interests. And of course, advance his interests at the same time, right? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of money involved in all of this, and there's a lot at stake for him. Trump's not going to be in the White House forever, and even if he wins a second term, and he's got kids and he wants to set himself up, and, there's no doubt in my mind that he's thoroughly corrupt and on every level, and they may even be having blatant conversations along this line. I wouldn't put it past them to, go, hey, Donnie boy, we got something for you here. and he carries it on. So I don't think that those are mutually exclusive. The idea that he would be enthralled to these fabulously wealthy, oligarch types around the world, including in the United States, and that those would be the people who have the most influence on him. I honestly don't think it's mutually exclusive at all. The fact that he's an idiot and the fact that these people are benefiting from that seems perfectly logical to me.
Yeah, I think people need to start. We need to start seeing more digging along these lines. I'm just convinced that these petty, lining of the pockets are really just sort of become almost like a metaphor for what's or some type of just representation of what is fundamentally driving this administration. I mean, Scott Pruitt asking his people to go around and look for hand lotion or whatever it is, I think is really, in some ways just sort of like a rear projection of the stuff that is really undergirding this entire administration. I mean, that's the only thing that makes sense. What is Donald Trump, what constituency possibly in Donald Trump's political universe is calling for Russia's readmission into the G7? Honestly, the only constituency would be, folks who have some type of financial interest in this. And
That would be the bottom line. But there is, it does trigger the libs. So there's always that as the, as a sort of upside.
But there's so much else that would trigger the libs, right? There's so much else. I don't know. I think that there's something else. I think there's something else going on with that, that I think is, if he was really in, if he didn't have anything to gain, he was just being afraid of being blackmailed. He could convince somebody, you don't want me going out there and calling for you to be put into the G7. I don't know. It just seems strange.
Look at it this way. There's more than just Russia, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a whole storyline that is, it's still pretty vague and muddled about the Middle East. I mean, you've got Eric Prince, right? You've got this guy George Nader, you've got all these doings with Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, along with Israel and everything there. I mean, we all know what's going on, the Middle East, and energy. I mean, it goes without saying that has to be sort of the locus of much of this interest and all the big money that's flowing. So, that is true. And maybe what you're talking about is, you've just got to go up 50,000 feet,
yep,
and look down and see what the big game is that's happening here. And it's really about resources and energy and all of that, which isn't surprising. And, historians 200 years from now will be able to look back and say, this was what was really going on. But in the middle of it, of course, and then you've got this big personality and this major, this narcissist, egomaniac that is, kind of dominating this whole scene in a very, kind of distracting way, and taking the world's only superpower and kind of shoving it right into the middle of all this. And not to say that America hasn't been in the middle of it from the get, right? I mean, we need energy too, right? So it's always been part of it. But this is kind of a different thing. This is the game of the oligarchs, not the game. I would suggest it's not even the game of the multinationals. This is really about very, very rich individuals those kind of people who can move the pieces on the board.
I think that's that's my sense as well. And what I mean, since we're talking about what is Rudy Giuliani doing in Israel?
Oh my God!
I don't understand. The guy is in the middle of an investigation. He's the president. What is he doing in Israel?
They paid him a bunch of money. I mean, this was an economic conference. It's called the Globe. You know, I don't know what the hell that is, but it's the Globe. And it was supposed to be about, you know, global markets and, you know, all of this. And they called him to talk about how politics are going to affect the global market. And, you know, he's there talking about how Stormy Daniels is a whore. You know, I mean, and it was unbelievable. Now, I think they paid him a lot of money. That's what he was doing there,
okay.
Of course.
Well, I guess I just answered my own question from 5 minutes ago. When you have a question, the answer is they made money off it.
They made money off of it. And it was, and you know, I mean, it was an astonishing display. I mean, I really couldn't believe it. And Trump defended him this morning, saying, you know, well, Rudy's Rudy, and he's doing a great job, you know. So apparently, Rudy going to a foreign country and talking about Kim Jong-un, crawling on his hands and knees, begging to get back into the summit, and that's the position Trump wanted him in, and saying that on the public stage just as he goes off to Singapore. You know, I mean, I have to admit, I give Kim real credit here for having the forbearance not to react to that. You know, I mean, so far anyway. I mean, who knows? But I mean, my God, you know, there, you've got this complete. You know, and obviously Rudy's speaking. You know, from if he's not speaking for the president, he's speaking from the perspective of conversations he's had with
right,
the president.
Right.
You know, this, of course, they
he's
talk
not,
on the phone.
He's not saying anything that is inconsistent with what he perceives Trump has said or wants to hear or feels, or he's just out there confirming.
And Trump didn't repudiate him.
Yeah.
You know, Trump didn't say anything. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I think he is speaking for him. And in fact, he even endorsed his view about Stormy Daniels. That, you know, porn stars don't have a reputation. You know, well, I'm not going to argue with that. And he gave a smug little smile, that misogynist piece of work. You know, so, you know, it was a terror. It was just a bizarre thing. He jumped into the middle of the Netanyahu corruption scandal and said he was all innocent. And then the women who were interviewing him on the stage kept saying, don't disrespect her, talking about Stormy Daniels. We don't disrespect women. He didn't care. He just kept, you know, barreling on. And then later that night, footage turns up of him dancing in a restaurant there, you know, waving a napkin over his head to some EDM with a bunch of waitresses. I mean, it was, I think he's drinking. I mean, I'm sorry. I honestly think he's drinking. This performance of his is way outside the boundaries, even of Trump world. I mean, he's in Scaramucci territory, maybe beyond Scaramucci territory, only he's doing it on the world stage, and he's interfering in, you know, I mean, he's, first of all, I don't think he's doing his client any good. I guess Trump thinks so, but I don't think he is. But I don't care about that. That's fine. Sabotage Trump. That's fine. But sabotage the Korean summit? I mean, that seems a bit much. And apparently they're just going to let it go. And a good for Kim. He's ignoring him. You know,
right.
that drunk old man over in Israel. Yeah, whatever. You know, I mean, I've got one too many dotards to deal with here, you know?
Exactly. I've got bigger fish to fry. So, all right, let's talk about this because there, you know, it seems, anything is possible, but it seems unlikely to me that Trump would be heading over there unless there was already basically more or less a deal in place. And now it's possible not, but, you know,
I don't know about that.
Well, we spoke to Tim Shurik last week, and he seemed to think that there was a lot of reason to believe that this was pretty close to being like, a done deal, that they'd already like sort of anticipated, like maybe on day two of the summit. Jai from South Korea will come up So let's just contemplate the world of that will be when Donald Trump comes back from this Singapore summit with a signed document that says North Korea agrees to denuclearize and perhaps, in exchange for these economic sanctions being dropped, we'll also liberalize X, Y, or Z, or we'll allow for travel across the DMZ for 5,000 families a year or something, you know, something to that effect, mm-hmm. right? Like, I have no idea what it would be, but I would imagine it would, you know, be structured some way like that. you know, and 5,000 U.S. troops are going to come home in the first 2 years from South Korea. And then maybe after that, I don't know, 1,000 a year. Who knows, right? I have no idea what would be the calculation here. But it's going to be a bit of a strange world, isn't it?
Well, look, I don't want to be lectured by the likes of Nicholas Kristof as a liberal who won't give Trump his due on this. So let me issue a disclaimer here. My belief is that anything that delays a crisis, I don't care what it is, and I felt this way back in the 90s when Clinton did it, and, you know, when Bush did it, Obama, everybody since the dawn of the North Korean nuclear program. If you can delay any kind of a crisis, if you can delay some kind of a moment of truth on this, great. You know, delay is better than not. And so that, you know, the alternative is so awful that you do whatever you can. So I give Trump credit. If he's able to sort of, you know, ratchet down the antagonism and, you know, giving Kim a world platform and all that stuff. Maybe, you know, now that he actually has a nuclear weapon, maybe that's the smart thing to do, you know, is to sort of offer him some concessions in the light of that. But the fact of the matter is he's not giving up his nuclear weapons. I mean, that's just not going to happen. You know, that's the Libya model. And he's not going for it. We're going to have to live with North Korea as a nuclear state, I believe. Now, maybe we can denuclearize the world, someone, not Donald Trump, but somebody might be able to. We get rid of all of them. I mean, maybe that, but right now, he is going to join the nations like, you know, some other nations like Pakistan and India. I mean, they're not exactly what you'd call, you know, in a stable situation either, and they're nuclear. Israel is a nuclear power. China, you know, there's a lot of them, and it's a horrible thing, but it is what it is. I mean, it is what it is. So if Trump can sort of, you know, put this into a situation where we're not actually confronting Kim, you know, setting off a nuclear bomb, that's a good thing. But, you know, I'm not going to, this has happened before. I mean, there have been a bunch of agreements with North Korea. This isn't new. It's right. Not something that, you know, he invented out of whole cloth. Now, he will portray it that way. Nobody's ever done what I did. No one was able to do it, blah, blah, blah. That's just not true. But again, you know, what about him is true? What does he say that is actually based in facts, generally speaking? So we're going to have to just, you know, allow this. Now, you know, he's not going to win the Nobel Prize. I honestly do not believe that those Swedes are going to give him the Nobel Peace Prize. But, you know, he'll get his accolades and people will say, well, you know, that's great. And he'll have his day. But my feeling about Trump, generally speaking, is that every story has, you know, a very short shelf life, and then, you know, we're off to the races on something else. So, you know, I don't expect this to have any long-lasting value other than the delay of, you know, the fact that Trump has now, he has a stake in not ratcheting up the crisis is a good thing. You know,
right.
It means that he has reason for his own sake to try and maintain a peace with North Korea. You know, you'd think any president would have that, but with Trump, it's obviously really important that it's personal and that it's about him and that his ego is massaged. So, you know, we get that out of this. And hopefully, you know, but who knows with these people? I don't make predictions with Trump because who knows? The whole thing he could end up stomping out and, you know,
right.
In declaring war. I mean, I don't know.
It also, I have to say, it's interesting to me because it's quite clear, at least in this aspect of foreign policy, the Bolton et al. Crew has mm-hmm. been completely sidelined. Now, maybe they come roaring back and they get their war with Iran. Maybe that's the deal, right? Like, but it is pretty stunning that. You know, there does seem to be some deliberate force behind this coming out of the White House. And I don't know if it's just political. Maybe it is.
Well, I don't know either. It is interesting that Bolton was sidelined. But from what I read, and I don't know if it's the whole story, but I think it was Politico had a story that Bolton was sidelined after the Libya model comment, and Pence and Trump went out and backed it, and in fact, and it blew up in their faces, and he and Trump was angry at Bolton about that, and he even, when he wrote that breakup note to Kim Jong-un, he made Bolton read it back to him. Like, this is what you've done.
You know, 100 times on the blackboard. Just do it. Yeah, write it. I will not say that thing about Libya again.
Bolton's in the doghouse. And Pompeo, who has sort of been the only one prepping Trump for that. And that's another thing. You know, I mean, Trump saying, I don't need to prepare. I've been preparing my whole life. You know, it's like, you know, what is this... It's just this endless kind of, you know, anti-intellectual, just, you know, and yet at the same time, I went to the best schools and I'm a genius, you know. It's like, it's just, it's insane. And the fact is, he isn't preparing. He didn't prepare. He doesn't know anything. Hopefully, this thing will be so choreographed,
right?
You know, as you say, that it, that there's nothing really to say other than, you know, it's all about the pageant. Everything's a photo op, and they already have all the, you know, paperwork in line.
If that happened, it was at record speed. I've been practicing my penmanship all my life.
All my life, I've been practicing.
I signed
it. Kim Jong-un. You know, but, you know, maybe that's happened, although it would be quite a feat because this thing has been happening at record speed, and usually these kind of things take forever. So maybe it's just sort of a you know, very basic framework, and he can get his picture taken, and we can, you know, they can march around wearing outfits, and, you know, everything will be, it's just that. We can hope. Because if he's actually in there negotiating something, if he actually has to say anything real, he doesn't have a clue. I mean, he doesn't even know what they're talking about. And Kim does. I mean, you know, this is his thing. So, you know, he's definitely prepared for it. So I don't know. You know, I mean, I suspect we're going to get something, and he'll come back, and he'll strut around, and, you know, everybody will say, oh, look at him. And, you know, we'll have Nicholas Kristof there, you know, lecturing us about how we need to give him his due. And, you know, Trump, maybe what he's doing isn't so bad, and maybe we ought to start backing his crazy, you know.
I mean, here's the thing, and this is, I want to... You know, I know we wanted to touch on immigration. We've talked about it a lot this way. I mean, it's quite clear, you know, what this administration's up to. But that idea of like the Kristof, you know, and this is finally the day that Donald Trump becomes president. Which, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't want to give the guy credit for stuff that he had nothing to do with, but when you're there, you get the credit for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how you slice it, if there's you know, some type of, like you say, some type of legitimate accord with North Korea. I mean, George Bush couldn't do it. Maybe he wasn't interested and they weren't focused on it, but...
Kim didn't have the nuclear weapon at that point either.
That's true.
You know, everything changed he got the nuke.
Right. True. And, but... let's talk about this. And you know, last week on Friday, we were talking about how anemic Chuck Schumer's response has been, and how just sort of like tin ear-ish, and him going out talking about gas prices, which was both like politically and policy wise, just sort of a joke, a horrible joke in some respects. The Democrats' leadership in the House, Nancy Pelosi, fresh off of her visit to Pete Peterson's funeral or whatever it was, his wake, I don't know what it was, are vowing to abide by pay-as-you-go rules, which means, like, we will not add a dollar to the deficit if they seize the majority next year. This is... absolutely insane in my mind. I mean, it's insane from a policy perspective. It's insane from a political perspective. It's insanity. What's the deal? I'm going to vote for the Democrats because I'm worried about the deficit. That's what the pitch is. Is that the pitch, that you should vote for Democrats if you're worried about the deficit?
Apparently, they think this is high on the list of priorities of Democrats at the moment. going, you know, how
it's
many?
It's not on the list of anybody. I mean, it's like literally aimed at the 8% of the electorate who, you know, actually believe that Paul Ryan is a brainiac. Like,
and those people are not going to vote for Democrats. If you think Paul Ryan's a brainiac, you're not voting for the Democrats, that's for sure.
I mean, this is so nuts that and I have been, you know, supportive of Nancy Pelosi in the past. I think she's done a good job in maintaining the, you know, sort of some type of discipline with her caucus and knew what she was doing when she brought up a vote. It won. It wasn't, you know, but this is sheer insanity. Like this makes me wonder, you know, I mean, this is, I don't know if the leadership is just simply a combination, like leadership is always going to be in a bubble, right? I mean, people who are politicians are going to be in some type of bubble, and you're going to be in a bubble when you're in leadership. And I don't know if it's like a combination of age and that bubble, but this is insanity. The idea that they even feel pressure to say it. I mean, like, I don't, this is completely, this is like, it, like, you know, some alien ship came and sucked me up by some tractor beam and dropped me in some type of like parallel universe. This is insane.
Well, I think I got the sense from it when I read the story that they think maybe that they're trolling Trump and the Republicans because they don't understand what trolling is. And so, you know, doing a capitulation like this and kind of basically tying their own hands behind their back, they think somehow they thought they were being clever and they were going to catch the Republicans, you know, selling out their own constituents in some way, and they're going to, you know, that they were really going to make them look bad. And this goes back, and I've been saying this for years, and so have you, going way back, you know, into the last decade. The idea that you're going to fight Republicans by calling out their hypocrisy and by saying that, you know, making their inconsistencies obvious is a fool's game. They don't care. They don't care. They don't give a damn about that. They really don't. I mean, if it isn't obvious now, then you'll never learn it. But that's what I think they think they're doing. And, of course, in the course of it, they're actually making a commitment to do it, which is even more crazy. They're not just saying it. They're saying, well, we really need to do this. It's like, are you kidding me? And, you know, this is, and it's not just that issue. It's not just PAYGO. It's across the board, this kind of milquetoast, you know, approach to this election. I mean, you've got a president here who is so loathed by the Democratic base that they will go, you know, to the ends of the earth to vote against the Republican Party and put out, you know, try and create some kind of check on his power. I mean, the guy is out of control, and Democrats hate his guts. I mean, I've never seen a president loathed this. I thought Reagan was loathed by Democrats, but, you know, by hardcore liberals. But this is, it's nothing compared to this. And they seem to be afraid of that. It's like, ooh, don't make trouble, you know. I still can't really wrap my mind around that. And so this is just part of that. They seem to be, you know, I think we need to go out and talk about our 10-point plan to, you know, raise the capital gains tax. That's really going to get people out. And I don't understand it. Now, as it turns out, you know, California, you know, we had our primary this week, and everybody was, you know, wringing their hands and going, oh my God, you know, we're going to lose, and everybody's apathetic, and turnout was low, et cetera. It's bullshit. It wasn't low. It was high. It was general election high. As the votes are coming, you know, California counts slowly, and a lot of it, we vote by mail. I do, especially in primaries. And, you know, the vote is coming in massive. And, you know, Democrats do care.
They got like another 2 million ballots. And like you say, I just want to, I mean, I know you just said this. I just want to reiterate this. I mean, this primary election is coming in at where a normal midterm election would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, California is a Democratic state. At one point, you can start to get these type of numbers, and it's going to be a bloodbath. because there's just not that many Republicans to come out. I mean, you know, you add 10 to 15% to turnout numbers and they're in big, big trouble.
They are in big, big trouble. And, you know, look, I don't want to make predictions about elections. I learned my lesson. But, you know, every indication has been since, you know, November 9th of 2016 is that the Democratic Party is very intensely focused on, you know, changing the situation. I mean, for whatever motives you have, whether or not you're a Bernie person or you're desperate to stop Trump or whatever your reasons are, you know, you've got issues, you care about this immigration situation. I mean, there are, you know, criminal justice, there are a million issues around which people are motivated to do something right now. And the idea that the Democrats are sitting there playing some game, that, I mean, even in the 90s, this PAYGO stuff was stupid. I mean, you know, it was always stupid. I don't even know why they're talking about it. I mean, it's ridiculous, but especially now, especially after Trump just blew, you know, I mean, the tax cut is, you know, how do you, you know, if they can't run on the tax, you know, if they want to do that, if they can't run on the tax cut for rich people, I don't know what they've got. So here we are. And I think, you know, look, something's going to change here. I don't you feel it that in the Democratic Party, we have a new generation coming up and this is not going to hold.
I hope it doesn't. I mean, and, you know, I don't know that Tim Ryan was the guy, but there needs to be some, I think there needs to be a challenge to the leadership wholesale. I mean, my fear is that, like, you know, you get rid of Nancy Pelosi and then you get Steny Hoyer, right, which I think is an even greater disaster. And so there really needs to be like some type of wholesale house cleaning. I don't know how that happens, though. I mean, in Sam Cedar's fantasy world, it's quite easy. They all just go away and they're replaced. But, you know, when you see people like Ellison sort of jumping into that AG spot, mm-hmm, it makes you wonder if, you know, any of the people in that generation, progressives, who feel like there's any opportunities here going forward, right? I mean, you're on the verge of taking back the House, and, you know, people in the top leadership of the Progressive Caucus want to get out? I don't know. I mean, maybe... I don't know what that means, but there's a real problem with the leadership of the Democrats now. And I include Chuck Schumer in that, who I think is even more problematic, because I would imagine when Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi go to the House, to the White House, when they're both minority leaders, that there's a deference to the Senate. And he's been, I think, an unmitigated disaster in terms of this role, you know, and this is what it reminds me of when Air America, after like the first two or three failed owners of Air America went away, we went into bankruptcy. We literally had no leadership. There was nobody. It was all middle management. We were just, everything was frozen. All expenditures, you could spend what you spent before. There was no new hires. There were no new fires. And the network was more successful than it had ever been, with literally no leadership. Each show just did what they did, and it was just like on inertia. And the burn rate was, you know, a fourth of what it would be 8 months later when we came out of bankruptcy. And that's the way I feel about the Democratic leadership now. It's like you know, the Democrats are doing okay despite their leadership. If anything, they're a net drag on everything that's going on.
I think so.
What it could mean when they take back the Senate and the House. I mean, it's just going to go immediately and into an internecine war because I think it's really problematic. I think it's going
to
be a real
problem. Look, it shouldn't be hard to be an opposition party, right? I mean, that this is not, you know, they can't pass any legislation. They can't. There's no way that their agenda is stalled until they gain power and probably gain the presidency, because they're, you know, Donald Trump is certainly not going to help them out. being an opposition party, and all they had to do was look at the Republicans, who, by the way, they are a terrible governing party. They're a really good opposition party. I mean, look at what they did during the Obama years, right. to obstruct his agenda. You know, this shouldn't have been hard. I mean, it really shouldn't have been hard. But they are reflexively unwilling to actually, you know, do any kind of real confrontation or to, you know, use the tools at their disposal. And they do have them. I mean, the first discharge petition that's coming out of the House is in the hands of Republicans, for crying out loud.
We should explain the discharge position is a basically a parliamentary move where you bypass leadership by getting enough signatures on a bill so that it goes to the floor without having to be brought up by the leadership.
Right, and the one that's being brought up is about DACA and immigration, which is great. I mean, glad to see it. You know, Trump won't sign it, but nonetheless, you know, this is a good thing. But it's being done to benefit moderate Republicans who are scared to death that they're going to get kicked out in November. You know, in places like California, Jeff Denham is the Republican that's you know, pushing this discharge position. This should have been done by Democrats. Yeah. I mean, this should have been something that was done to benefit Democrats, not to benefit moderate Republicans. Even if you drag some moderate Republicans onto it, it should be a Democratic initiative to do this. And throughout there, they should have been trying to do this stuff. But for reasons that I don't understand, you know, look, I give Nancy Pelosi a lot of credit. She has been a good speaker in terms of strategy within her caucus, right, to get people together, as you pointed out. She really does know how to count votes. She knows how to maneuver to actually win when they're trying to win. But I don't think any of them know how to be an opposition party. I think that it makes them very uncomfortable. I think they are, I'm talking about the leadership, I think they are just temperamentally designed or you know, attuned to, you know, being bipartisan and, you know, and cooperative and all of that, because they listen to these focus groups where they ask everybody, do you want bipartisanship? And everybody's, oh, yeah, that's what we want more than anything. We want everyone to agree to be bipartisan. What they don't, if you drill down to that comment, what people are really saying is, I want everybody to do what I want them to do.
Right.
That's not the same thing, right? I mean, bipartisanship and compromise and all that, people don't know what that really means in terms of legislative, you know, negotiations. They don't, you know, that's not what they, that their
focus groups are always like, you know, I think people should eat healthy as they, you know, munch on the Twinkie and the, and you know, the corn chips that they have in front of them. I mean, that's basically exactly what it comes down to. No, definitely.
And everybody's talking to each other. You know, you're in a room full of people, and you say what you think people want you to say, right? I mean, that's just human nature. You're sitting around, and, you know, yes, maybe there's one or two guys, you know, who might step up and say something, you know, a little bit off base. Or if you've got a focus group, a bipartisan focus group, you have the Republicans saying one thing and the Democrats saying another. It is not useful, really, I don't think. I don't think it's as useful for politics as people think it is. I really don't. I really find it to be something. And the Republicans pay no attention to that stuff, by the way. They really don't. They are much more, you know, sort of gut-focused and, you know, much more, you know, just straight-up ideological, and they're trying to figure out how to get their message out. And they don't really, you know, if they listen to somebody saying bipartisanship, they go, oh, that's nice. That's nice, but it won't work. So, you know, let's move on. I mean, and the Democrats take this stuff very seriously and really believe that this is the way to govern. And it just, I don't think it's working. And I don't think it has worked very well for them over the course of time. I don't think it worked well with Obama either. You know, this was the kind of governance, you know, he thought that his grand bargain was, you know, the way to, it was going to solve all of our problems.
Right.
Well, you know, we saw how that worked out, right? I mean, we ended up in a horrible mess and paved the way in a lot of ways for Donald Trump.
Digby, always a pleasure, if not somewhat painful.
Yeah, well, you know,
what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do?
Pleasurably painful. That's what they call me.
thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks. Have a great weekend, Sam.
All right. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We have a Jimmy Roofcake song, right? We'll play it after. What's that?
And say if you want that now, we can.
Why don't we play it after after we get Isabel? All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Isabel Gillies will join us right after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. The person who launched 1,000 theme songs. We actually do have multiple theme songs for this person. The only person who inspired multiple theme songs. Do we have one of them ready, Matt?
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Yes, indeed, and that of course is the Jimmy Reefer Cake version. We had at least one or two other, I think, Isabel Gillies theme songs that came in over the years. And,
I think there were three, but that's my favorite. I love that song.
Are you on a speakerphone? What happened? It feels like you walked away from your phone.
What?
It feels
can you
like
hear me?
Yeah. What are you? Are you talking on a headset?
Yeah, I'm talking on a headset.
Try talking.
Is that bad?
Try talking right into the phone. Let's see how this goes. Doesn't it sound like she's like on like a speakerphone?
How's
like
that?
That's much better. The other one
is
sounded
that much better.
Yeah, the other one sounded like you were like across the kitchen. It sounded like you were in the kitchen. Oh. Are you in the kitchen?
I am in the kitchen.
Well, there you go. And now I can picture it. I've been to your. I've within the past couple of months been to your place. I don't want to talk out of turn.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, for an exciting event, I will say.
It was an exciting event. But Isabel Gillies, we're not here to talk about that. You were...
No.
Now, I want to admit something up front. I didn't watch Anthony Bourdain's TV shows very much at all. You know, I'm not a foodie per se. I mean, I was aware of him, and I was aware of his politics, where I thought were pretty good. So I'm not, and I'm generally not as emotionally involved in a lot of things. But give me your reaction, because I know that I can tell from your Twitter feed that you're feeling it.
I think I think I watch his show once or twice a week on Netflix. And I mean, I've been aware of Anthony Bourdain since I went to Layal, his restaurant in, back in the 90s.
Wait, was Layal his place?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That was right down on 28th and Park. That was right down the street from from my first apartment. Oh, I used to eat there a lot. I didn't realize that was his place.
Yes. And to me, as a young 20 something, It when we'd go with, you know, group, and it was like the first time that I thought, oh my God, restaurants aren't just like places to eat. They're like, it's cool. And I felt sexy, and it was like a scene, not a scene, like a stupid scene. It was like, you know, once I saw Daniel Day-Lewis there, I saw him, he walked across the restaurant holding on to, he must have been his daughter or some young child's ponytail, being led into the restaurant. And I was like, oh my God. And the food was so sort of comforting, but French and well done. And I loved that restaurant. And then Kitchen Confidential. Well, first there was the New Yorker article, about the restaurant world, kind of, and then the book came after that, and that book knocked my socks off. And it, because I worked in restaurants, it was like, yes, that's exactly what it's like. And he had this voice he loved giving a voice for the people who worked in restaurants that never had a voice and never, you know, but really are the heart and soul and sort of engine of restaurants. And he gave them so much credit, and to me, he was such a generous person. It's gonna make me cry. In his early work, and then later his work when he travel around the world and shine lights on all these different parts of the world and different countries and what the sort of economic scene there was and the political scene, and he tied it all in with food, and it was just generous. It was so generous of him, because it couldn't have been easy to go to all those places and travel so much. And but he did it with abandon and with this like twinkle, and he was such a badass, and he was so kind. And I find this, that he died, so it seems to have shattered something in not just like for me at all, but like everyone I know seems sort of crushed by it. And that he committed suicide is, you know, we've had two celebrity suicides this week.
It is, there's also, and, we should also say that there's been like a 25% rise in suicide since 1999. And I mean, a big part of that, I think, could be a function of the 2008 financial crisis. In some instances,
maybe isolation because of the internet and phones. And, there seems to be I think I read today that it's 195 people commit suicide an hour in the United States.
Jeez.
I don't know if I have that exactly right, that number, cause I've read a lot today, because people are being, you know, tweeting, and there are a lot of articles about reaching out and getting help and bringing some illumination to mental health issues, and it, which I think, is so important. And I've had in my own life, been touched by mental illness, not myself personally, but people I am very, very extremely close to. And, you know, it's a mysterious and frightening and shrouded in shame and shrouded in mystery. And that should all come crashing down. All of that shame around it should just be gone now. And always should have been.
I mean, but it's been a long time coming. I mean, wasn't it like Betty Ford even? She was talking about depression maybe. Maybe it was more she was talking about
alcoholism.
But it was depression. I'm just thinking of political figures, I guess. But yeah, it's messed up. I mean, culturally and in terms of resources in this country, we don't really pay much attention to it, it seems.
Well, and I think it's so frightening. I think that the thought of someone taking their own life is so hollowing and so crippling that, you know, even with the best people on earth wanting to talk about it, it's so scary, you know. But the truth is, and what's so important, there was a great article, actually New York Times had a really good article that was sort of like what to do to help. And the big resounding message at the end was this issue does have help. There is help to get, and suicide is preventable. But you have to know how to handle it. And so, you know, knowing is better than not knowing. So informing yourself about how to help someone in your life or how to get help if these feelings and this stuff is happening to you is just paramount. And the thing is about Anthony Bourdain, and the reason why I would recommend his shows on any day of any year, but obviously today this is the recommendation I have, is just go and watch him, because whatever you're interested in, if it's politics, if it's travel, if it's geography, if it's cities, if it's food, he touched on all of it. He touched on human rights. He touched on women's rights. He was so passionate, but not in a like a soapboxy way. He just talked about it. He was like, he talked about food the same way he would talk about a socioeconomic issue. He was like, this is what the deal is here. Like, let's look at it. Let's talk about it. Like, this is good, this food. Let's look at it. Let's talk about it. Where does it come from? Where does it come from in your family? Where is it? He really talked to people. And he was smart. You could tell he was so smart. And his writing is so good. So in Kitchen Confidential, you just rip through it because it's so interesting. But also, his language was so good. He was a real talent. And obviously, he must have been... You get from his work that he wasn't, you know... that he was a complex person and that he had demons. But I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, he, was an addict and had gone through, I think, a lot of stuff emotionally. I mean, I guess the tricky part with a lot of this is also, it's not just, you know, sort of knowing where, you know, as someone who is not the person who is suffering, but to know where to send someone or how to get someone help is tricky. But the hardest part, it seems to me, is to know when someone needs that help.
Right, because a lot of people, and we saw this with Kate Spade this week, and you hear this typically. First of all, a lot of people who commit suicide don't have a mental illness diagnosis. So and because it's so shrouded in shame and guilt, and you know, people hide it, and so it's hiding in plain sight. And I think that's where information is really important. And so today, if you're listening, you know, look for that article in New York Times. Look for there are many news places that are putting out information of how to tell, how to see what the signs are. And I'm not an expert by any means. So I would just refer anyone to the people that are, and it's all over the internet today, especially. But there are ways to tell, and there are ways to help people. And I think the biggest way is by saying, I see you're hurting. I see that something's happening. Can you talk to me about it? Do you need to talk to somebody else about it? You know, really just going in there and being there for people and being in touch and telling them that they're not alone and that you're there to listen or help, I think is where to start for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I guess to the extent that I have some experience in knowing about suicides, it's people who you didn't necessarily know. Even the people closest to them know that it was sort of at that point. And that's that I think is super scary. And particularly also, you know, with kids and whatnot as well, with teenagers and...
Well, I also, I do want to talk about that because I guess it's because I have teenagers and I hear what's in their zeitgeist, or do we all have the same zeitgeist? You know, mental health is, thank God, something that they talk about a lot, but it's also something that, you know, with TV shows like 13 Reasons Why and, you know, safe spaces and triggering, all these words and all this stuff is something that they're really, if they really talk about and they really seem to know about, but it's, this is heavy stuff. And sometimes I, you know, there's so much anxiety. I mean, there's Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. There's, and some of my own family suffers from anxiety. And so I just, it seems like so much pressure on them in a way, or it's such a big subject that I hope they're getting enough help. I hope they're getting enough time to discuss it and to, you know, people are being careful to make sure that they're really talking about it fully and all the way through. And do you find that with your kids, with Myla? I mean, 13 Reasons Why is a huge, I mean, it's all about suicide. It's a huge Netflix show.
Wow, I haven't seen that. I don't think
very she's... controversial because some people think it's triggering. Some people think it brings to light teenage suicide.
Well, there's an interesting theory about that I was reading that, I can't remember who wrote, maybe it was Malcolm Gladwell. It was one of those things. And I'm always a little bit suspect because sometimes that science gets a little bit too glossy when he writes about it. But there was some suggestion that that there is a sort of a viral quality to school shootings. And that, you know, these things become inspirations for the next one. And so, you know, who knows if that is part of when it comes to suicide, too. Just sort of the...
Well, I read some stuff about that today. And there was another article in the Times that, in fact, there is some evidence that especially celebrity suicides tend to inflame or ignite maybe they're triggering, maybe they're, for whatever reason, it seems to be.
I mean, when we were kids, I remember there would be like rashes of teen suicides in like localized areas, right? Like where one person would commit suicide and then like four or five kids would commit suicide there. That type of thing. And I don't know if that's indicative of that dynamic or... If I don't know. I mean,
well, I know in schools, if there's any kind of you know, anything to do with self harm, schools are very careful around it because it's like wildfire. It can just go rip through a school. You know, with like cutting. There's a whole lot of self harm. Stuff is such a bad word, but there's surrounding this mental health issue, there's a lot of ways that people don't treat themselves well, and why that's happening now more. I mean, I gotta tell you, I we're not living in a time right at this moment that there's not a lot of. I mean, I can't talk about climate change with some of my kids because they get so freaked out. This morning before I heard about Anthony Bourdain, I just couldn't read Twitter anymore. I was so freaked out by the summit and by Trump's handling of it and how he, you know, I'm sure it's frightening.
Right.
I wonder if that's not affecting some of this, you know, there's a lot of angry talk. There's a lot of vitriol. It's gotta be affecting people.
Quite seriously.
It's
possible. I mean, it's certainly possible. You know, and I think, but you know, we had a year or two ago, I think we had the first time we had the mortality rate for white men went up, or I should say the word's escaping me, but the age in which people were dying was actually getting lower. Than higher for the first time in decades. And it was a one-off, but not such an anomaly that it wasn't indicative of at least a partial trend. And that was a function of suicide and OD, probably largely from opioids. So
the opioid. Yeah.
There's a whole lot of different factors that I think they're playing into this. I mean, certainly I think there's a lot of data out there showing that kids are more anxious, to a large extent, I think because of the types of social media that they're engaging in. Right. I mean, every time you put up a post, you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense to us. But I mean, I understand the dynamic of we put up a video, we want it to do well. If I'm a kid and I'm, got a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 15-year-old sort of perspective on the world. I put up a picture and it's an extension of myself, and my self-esteem is really wrapped into that, how many likes that picture gets.
Oh,
I mean, a constant source of anxiety, I think.
It is. And there was that article in The Atlantic that pointed out that there was the person who wrote it was studied demographics and studied, numbers. Right. So it was teen suicide is up. Teen pregnancy is down.
Right.
People aren't connecting. They're isolated. They're isolated, and they're not only are they isolated, they feel they're isolated with a machine that's telling them that's giving reinforcement to their fears. Like if you're in eighth grade and you're Sam or Isabel in 1984, you're sitting at home alone. You have no answering machine. You have no telephone. You're just like, oh, I'm sad. I'm alone. But if you then put a machine in your hand that you see the party that you're not at.
Yes.
And
definitely.
And you've just tweeted something, or you've just put a Snapchat story out and no one likes it. And then you see that someone unfollowed you, and then put one more on top of that, that someone might have been mean to you. Someone might have said something that's actually mean on social media. How could it not affect a generation?
When
really negatively.
When my daughter did not get into the school that she wanted to, or that she thought she wanted to, for middle school.
Because
in New York, it's you've got to compete essentially to get into middle school, which is just in and of itself another insanity. But that moment when I realized if this was me and I got disappointed, when I was not nominated for AZA 685 president as a junior or whatever it was that got me mad at that age, I go home and I'd sit in my room and,
listen to some music
or whatever. For kids her age, their source of solace is to go and, go on to social media. But on the social media is where you get the, I got into the school I wanted to get into. And you cannot escape it in the same way. It's brutal in that respect.
It's brutal.
And I don't know if this relates. The implications of having any type of emotional issues or depression in this type of context has got to make it even that much more worse. I mean, obviously, it's a different, you're a celebrity like Anthony Bourdain, and,
that's got to be different than what we're talking about.
Right.
But I do think that
There are dynamics that are similar, right? I mean, he's whatever demons he had and whatever things that he looks at that made him, be able to interpret the valuelessness of his life. Certainly he had access to that information, right? I mean, it's a filtering in. I mean, he's not,
I just can't, when you look at his work, when you look at his TV show, as I hope people will do like this afternoon or tonight, the thing that's so, the dichotomy there, the sort of thing that's so shocking is like, he's so curious. Like, you just think he wants to go to the next town and the next town and the next country. And like, what is it about this place that makes it tick? It's such a opposing instinct than to end your own life. It seems so puzzling. And it's just so sad. Cause the generosity was so, it just seemed to flood out of him so easily. Like it was his nature to want to share, like investigate, find out, and then share it. He's prolific.
Yeah, it's a shame. And the guy seemed like a very decent from a politics standpoint. I think also like we said, he humanized a lot of people.
Yeah.
And
he called out a lot of people, and he spoke the truth. I mean, I think he was pretty familiar with speaking truth to power.
Can people see Netflix runs his shows? I imagine CNN.
Netflix runs both shows, CNN. So Netflix, you can get it, probably now they'll probably highlight it. But there was Parts Unknown, and then there was Parts Unknown is a CNN show, and the first show is I'm getting confused.
No reservations.
So, and then his books. If you haven't read anything, I am the first book to read is Kitchen Confidential, which is happens to be I have the same editor right now. Karen Rinaldi, who sort of is just an amazing editor.
Isabel, are you there? Somehow we lost her. Hold on, let me just call her back so we can...
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you for a second.
Oh, sorry. Kitchen Confidential really blew the roof off of restaurant life, and it's really funny too. It's funny and it's beautifully written, but it's gritty, and it talked all about what it was like to work in a kitchen. It's just a great read, and then. And all of his TV shows are great. Even the TV shows, because he made fun of himself too, because he sort of thought it was embarrassing that he was a Food Network star or like a celebrity chef, kind of sickened him a little bit, and he talked about that a lot. But even the goopier stuff when he would be on the Food Network on sort of a reality contest or something, he was great. He was great. He was personable and he had a. Just a charm about him that will take you. You could watch it for hours. You really, really could.
All right. Well, Isabel, sad day, but I appreciate the recommendation and the talk.
Well, I always appreciate it, and love you. And I think what a big message of today and of every day should be. But honestly, it's tell people in your life you love them and be there for each other. And so, that's just where I'll leave it, I guess. Love you.
Thanks, Isabel. All right, you too. Bye-bye.
I agree.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Well said.
Isabel Gillies, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Let's, this song was submitted by Jimmy Reefcake.
Yep.
Is he still on the Doors kick?
It appears so.
Now, to be fair, this was from a week ago. So he was on a Doors kick a week ago still.
What is the what is the
it's called Writers on
Jamie's Gorkaying him.
Doors.
What
I actually got a little tidbit of information from Jimmy Reefer Cake about this Doors streak that he's on. In the form of a question slash comment that he sent to us at the Antifada. And he said that he is going to perform only Doors songs until weed is legal. So there
Oh, boy.
We're going to really need to speed that up.
Like, I told him he should be doing it outside the legislator's offices.
Right. Nationally? Or
he did not specify.
Well, I mean, it's legal in Nevada. Right? I mean, it's perfectly legal in Nevada.
I guess he must mean everywhere.
Oh.
The whole entire world, guys. Oh.
Going to really get into that back catalog.
He's really hunkered down.
He's really going to make us pay
for
this.
How many fake blues songs did they do?
Whoa.
So, too many.
All right. So, what is the name of this?
This is called Riders on the Stormy. Right.
That is good.
You know what? I think that this is actually not necessarily bad for arc.
I think
he's been having a bit of a resurgence with this.
He's got some riders, form and structure.
Exactly.
Riders on the Stormy.
Riders on the Stormy. Riders on the Stormy. She makes all the best porn. She has the perfect form. If you really need a bone, a porn actor out on loan. Riders on the Stormy. All right. Trumpy blows his little load.
Oh, God.
His brain is squirming like a toad. I love that part. With minimal foreplay. Be quiet and Trump pays. She gave Donald Trump a ride, wishes the memory will die. Riders on the storm. Yeah, girl, you gotta love your man. You gotta love your money, man. Take him by the hand. Make him understand. You can get a TV show if you act like you're his hoe. Gotta love your man. All right.
Yes.
Wow.
I think this is his best song in years.
Bravo.
There we go.
You know, this as...
Wow. Wow.
That was
as
great.
As you guys may know, this is not my favorite song, but I think it's been really elevated by the Jimmy Reefer Cake treatment.
There you go.
That's so good.
I mean,
this might be the
I gotta
the
say the
first Jimmy song I'm gonna re-listen to.
The fact that Riders on the Stormy was not the first Doors song that he came up with is pretty amazing. All right, folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your membership to produce itself, to reproduce itself every day. That is our theory of podcast reproduction around here. Without our members, we are nothing. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com and get access to the member show and support the free show. And, of course, today is Friday, which means that several days ago was Tuesday, which means that the Michael Brooks Show is already up and posted on iTunes, at Patreon, and on our YouTube channel. This week's show involved...
I thought you were going to say Assad Haider on identity politics, the history of identity politics, and Ilona Minkowski was in studio. What is that noise?
I don't know. It sounds like something strange is going.
Yeah, that sounds, well, I think it's just a cop car, but it did sound kind of startling.
It sounds sort of weird. Also,
just the Chupacabra coming for us.
Can
don't
I
worry
just
about
mention
it.
Really, really quick, too, that there's a third piece of regular Patreon content that patrons of TMBS get now.
Don't think so.
Well, it already happened. Can I explain it for a second?
No. Well, I think.
Don't think so.
Why does that say "don't think so"?
I don't. Think
oh, okay.
So.
That's "I don't."
It's all coded.
That's a lot better. Oh, did you get the Pusha T thing?
All right, go ahead.
Waz and I have our own separate. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
So don't forget, check out the Waz and Michael separate thing on Patreon. Also, Jamie, the Antifada. Did you guys? What did you guys do? Did you guys do one this week?
Hell yeah. I actually phoned in from Texas.
Phoned it in?
Where I was. Yes, I literally phoned it in from Hill Country. And we took a bunch of our listeners' questions, which was very nice and cool and exciting for us. It's cool to see all the quality people we have out there listening and engaging with our show. So
check it out.
We're probably going to post that later tonight.
Patreon.com/TheAntifada. And of course, Matt is just basking in the glory of his release of Literary Hangover.
More and more people are talking about it. Literary Hangover. It's getting an very intellectual big podcast.
And you guys talk Orwell on this one or something like that?
Tomorrow.
Because Orwell's getting really big now. He's doing very well.
Orwell, yeah, more and more people are talking about George Orwell, and that's including us tomorrow, which we recorded that in 2016. The next real episode is going to be released the next Saturday, which is on Rip Van Winkle by Washington Irving.
Really?
Ooh, interesting. I just started listening to it, and I enjoy it very much.
I've been on the Rip Van Winkle Bridge. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.